This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is It Was a Thing on TV.
Episode 24.
Star number one.
Submission 330. The half-hour CDI commercial called The Meaning of Life.
What is
well,
going
folks,
on?
This is I gotta say, on? This is something we've been looking forward to since we came up with the idea for this show back in September. This has been something that has been on me and Mike's minds for 25 years. And now finally, folks, we're going to share with you. You might have seen this infomercial back in the day while you were randomly churning through all the channels. You might know CDI as that system that the Angry Video Game Nerd made fun of once. You might know the CDI as that system that has those crappy Zelda games and Hotel Mario, but no, folks. The CDI has a special place in our hearts because of this infomercial from 1994 that told us what this bad boy was all about.
So what is this bad boy all about?
Okay, well, what the CDI originally was supposed to be, or where it came from, was Philips, back in the day, was going to make an add-on for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System, a CD add-on. However, that never came to fruition.
I'm sure most of you know the story with the CD-ROM add-on for the Super Nintendo. But if not, long story short, Sony was originally going to make a CD add-on for the Super Nintendo. And then Nintendo realized, oh crap, we made a bad deal with Sony because they're going to get all the money on the sales of the hardware and the software. Hey, Philips, do you want to help us make a CD-ROM add-on for the Super Nintendo? Okay. Then they went ahead and tried to make the add-on for the Super Nintendo. That didn't happen. Meanwhile, Sony was like, you know what? Let's take this video game thing and make something of it. And then they came out with the PlayStation.
And now you know the rest of the story.
Thank you, please, Iris.
Please continue.
And yeah, that's video game history right there. Because PlayStation, well, we know what's happened to the video game consoles over the last 20 years or so. So what ultimately happened, Sony with their add-on became the PlayStation 1, and the Philips version became the CDI. And the CDI, and I say this as an owner of a CDI, I'll get to that story in a little bit. The CDI wasn't a video game system per se. It was like an all-around entertainment system. Obviously, you could play regular audio CDs on it. There were video CDs for the CDI, so you could watch movies.
But you had to have a very special MPEG card attached.
Yeah. It's a little cartridge. It's not terribly big. It's about the size of maybe a big harmonica, and you just put this chip. It's essentially like a big chip into the CDI system, and you're allowed to then watch these movies and full-length movies at that.
Yeah, it's like the. You remember when the original Xbox had that little dongle with the DVD remote to let you play DVDs on it?
Yeah.
That was sort of like that.
And in addition to the movies and games, there were educational titles. Like I said, you could play CDs, normal audio CDs. It did have an okay memory. I mean, it wasn't a lot. It was back in 1994, 1995. But if you turn the machine off without properly shutting down, you lost your entire memory. And so that means if you had any saved games or saved playlists, or even I think you had to reset the time. The time didn't even save if you shut it down correctly. You had to reset up everything. Again, 1994 technology. It's not like nowadays where they have automatic backing up and saving of files and whatnot. The interesting one of the interesting things about the CDI is the controllers themselves One was very reminiscent of like a Sega controller, but with three buttons. It was actually like a combination of the Sega controller, the Genesis controller, and the SNES controller. It was shaped like the SNES controller, but it didn't have four buttons. It had three, sort of like the Genesis, albeit, you know, the Genesis really had six buttons.
I believe Gravis made that controller. I may be wrong on that. But they did. But Gravis did make a controller for the system.
There were also remote controls for it, which really trying to play a game on a big remote control. It wasn't even like a small remote control. It was a big pain in the butt. The model that I got, it came with a controller that really could be best described as about the size of a Wii remote, a Wiimote, if you will. It's about the same size, except it has a round top. And there were two buttons, and they were on either sides of this round circle, circular top. And it was very, very wacky to control, especially, again, if you're playing a video game, trying to get your fingers in the right positions to use those buttons that aren't, like, naturally where joystick buttons would be. It was good in theory, but very badly laid out. Also, with some games, I had an issue where if you, like, push the pad down too hard, if you got a little forceful with the pad, it sort of screwed it up a little bit. And that actually was an issue I had with the first one of those controllers I owned, playing the tennis game that I think was a default game that came with the CDI. But also, on top of that, there were reference types of discs. There was a Compton's Encyclopedia. There were kids' games. There was The Art of Robert Mapplethorpe. There were
No. It was the Flowers. It was
The Flowers of Robert Mapplethorpe. I know.
Yes.
But Robert Mapplethorpe was an artist. Yeah, I know it was Flowers.
Because Robert Mapplethorpe, as we all know from that Anchored video game nerd video, he really liked to take pictures of flowers.
Flowers.
Yes, he did. And there are other reference and resource types of games, educational games. I think Muzzy had a game, if you remember the Muzzy ads back in the 90s, teaching you how to say friends. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think Muzzy had a game. So there was a good variety of games, but it just never caught on.
Well, and here's the thing. Everyone nowadays, when you think of the CDI, everyone thinks of it as like a primary video game console, but the CDI was never marketed as a video game console.
Oh, by no means.
No!
And another issue is, like, nobody sold the discs. I mean, based on my experience, there were two places I saw the CDI discs being sold. One was at Best Buy, and that was like the first year or two that Best Buy came to this area, like 94, 95, 96. And then I found through Sears. Sears had a limited supply of CDI games. And that's actually how I got the Jeopardy game, because they had the Jeopardy game at one of the local Sears stores. So the availability was ridiculous. I mean, it wasn't something you'd find at GameStop or Funko Land.
So you didn't find them at? Because I used to frequent the Babbage's over at Cross Creek here in Fayetteville, and they had like one shelf with three CDI games. And the three games, I kid you not, were Zelda the Wand of Gamelon, Hotel Mario, and the Joker's Wild.
You see, now, I only had one Babbage's in this area when I was when the CDI was out, and I never went to Babbage's because it was just out of the way. The store that's related to that, which was closer to me, was Electronics Boutique, which was owned by the same general company, and I don't remember them having CDI games. They carried, like, Neo Geo. That was their thing, at least it.
Ours carried the Neo Geo too, but that was behind the desk. You had to ask for that.
Well, yeah, that was a big money product. That was like $700 back in the game, and the games were like $150 a piece.
Okay, now I've already shared my CDI story from episode 3, but you want me to go over it again?
Sure.
Sure, why not?
The CDI would be displayed at a CompUSA that my dad would go to all the time. And do you know what the one game was that they would demo on the CDI there at the CompUSA where my dad would frequently go at?
What was that?
Mad Dog McCree.
Nice.
And it's a good way of displaying the technology because you had to have that light gun.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, every time you would fail, you'd get that damn Undertaker telling you how many lives you had left.
Which is not creepy at all, by the way.
No, but you know how people would have loved to have shot the dog in Duck Hunt? I would have liked to have shot that damn Undertaker, let me tell you.
Wow. That got dark rather quickly.
Well, my CDI story very quickly. Like I said, I did own one. I did fall in love with it watching this infomercial we're going to talk to. I fell in love with the CDI through this infomercial we're eventually going to talk about in this show. But what happened is back in early 1995, so it was about almost 20 years ago, I was not making a lot of money, and actually I was very, very bad with my money. And I'm not joking about this when you hear this. I had a vision, I had a dream one night that I went to a certain place and bought a lottery ticket, a scratch-off ticket at noon that next day, and it was a big winner. And it's like, okay, this is a dream in my mind, but I'm going to do this anyhow. So I was actually in school at the time, and I think I had a break during classes, and I went to the place I saw in my dream, which it doesn't exist anymore, and I bought two lottery tickets, two scratchers at $1 a piece. And lo and behold, one of them, I don't remember, I think it was the first one of the two, was a winner of $1,000. And I mean, immediately, like, you know, I'm like really thankful, you know, oh my gosh, this vision I had happened. And so the first thing I did besides cash the ticket and get the money is I paid my car insurance bill because car insurance was due at the end of that month, that February. I didn't want to be burdened with that, get that out of the way. But then I had, after taxes, like about, and after the insurance, I think I had like about $600 left, $500. And I said, you know what? I'm buying that CDI. So after school that day, after college, I went down to Best Buy, I bought the system, and I bought about a half a dozen games, and it was like $520. I mean, I had maybe like $50 left over after it was all said and done, but I got my CDI, and I was happy. And that's the story of how I met my CDI.
Okay, we're going to go have some dinner now. But, okay, so you have an interesting story about the CDI, and you, Greg, have an interesting story about the CDI, but still, you gotta, if you want to have, you know, all of this sort of success, you gotta know how to market it. Enter 1994, where we get this infomercial with a man who is either Jonathan Mangum or a man with a similar haircut talking to a giant wall, asking one important question that, you know, truth be told, we've all asked at one point of our lives.
What? Deal or no deal?
Oh, God! That's another podcast! Now, the question is, what is the meaning of life?
Yes.
And the meaning of life is the CDI.
Well, of course it is. Because, I mean, what other system is going to have Hotel Mario on it?
And not just the Joker's Wild, but the Joker's Wild Jr.
With Mark Summers, baby.
Or Burn Cycle, which, if you ask me, is the best CDI title. But that's another story for another day. We're talking about this infomercial, which It sort of looks like the Macintosh 1984 commercial meets Time Tracks. Feature installment Time Tracks.
That's actually a good comparison. That's a good mashup. And so what the meaning of life is the CDI, but not just the CDI itself, but again, the versatility. You can play kids' games. You can play video games. You can play movies. You can play CDs. You could do anything that CDI has software for. And so we get a lot of previews of the different games. So, yeah, for the kids, there's the Berenstain Bears. As I said earlier, there's Muzzy.
It's Berenstain Bears, Mike.
That's what I said. It's the Berenstain Bears.
It's not Berenstain Bears. It's Berenstain Bears.
I said Berenstain.
No, I thought you said
it's Berenstain. The Berenstain Bears, ladies and gentlemen.
Clean out your ears. Get a Q-tip. I said Berenstain Bears.
# Mandela Effect.
So they went through like each of the different genres of games or of products, let's say, not really games, because as we said earlier, you have the kids' games, and then you've got reference games. We mentioned the Compton's Encyclopedia, and you've got videos in the Compton Encyclopedia, which for 1994 I thought was pretty cool. You've got the Flowers of Robert Mapplethorpe, as we mentioned earlier. You've got, I think they even added like collections of literature possibly. Because who wants to play video games when you could read on your CDI?
But we got one big game, baby, that was demoed on this infomercial. And you know what I'm talking about, Mike.
Ooh, I want to know what you're talking
yes.
about.
There's a number of games that were demoed, but this is the one that I think has the biggest legacy with the CDI.
I'm talking about NFL Football Trivia Challenge, baby.
Oh, I thought you were going someplace else.
for it. But yeah, NFL Ultimate or NFL Football Trivia Challenge hosted by Pat Summerall, which is apparently part of the meaning of life. The meaning of life is to know useless football trivia.
And that's actually one of the first games that I got was that game.
Hey, if anybody could be God, I'm pretty sure it could be Pat Summerall.
I am not in disagreement with that.
But yeah, that was one of the first games I got was the NFL game. And it was very interesting. I mean, there are a lot of video clips, but I mean, brief, short, very low resolution video clips, but it was very interactive. It was a good use of the technology, and it sort of played on the football motif of if you get to the end zone by scoring, so many questions correct before getting so many wrong, I believe you ended up getting 7 points, and it did take football to another level, but it was hosted by the great Pat Summerall, who was doing NFL on Fox at the time.
Yeah, because 94 would have been already NFL and CBS would have been done that year. So Fox would have gotten the NFC rights that year, and they would have just started with football.
Exactly. The one thing that I was missing, though, was no John Madden because, he was attached to another video game series.
That's another podcast, though.
Yeah, but we also had another trivia game that was featured on this infomercial.
Sandy's Circus Adventure? No.
And I think this is where Mike knew I was going with before I said NFL football tribute.
No, this actually isn't where I thought you were going, but continue.
Oh, geez. I wonder what this actually is. But no, they demoed The Joker's Wild with Wink Martindale on CDI.
Which actually was a very good adaptation. The only problem is it was all multiple choice. And there were a couple of different rules changes. After somebody got to $500, then you just spun the wheels trying to build up money without hitting a devil. If you hit a devil, you went back to whatever your score was after the first round. But you could freeze at any time, and basically the other player or players had to surpass that amount of money to win the game and play the bonus round, which was one trivia question, one multiple choice trivia question. And if you got it right, you got, I think it was either a dollar sign or a letter B next to your listing in the high scores because you got the bonus question right.
But one of the great things about that game is you could put basically almost any name and Wig Martindale would say the name in the game.
Well, now I'm going to clarify that. There was a pre-populated list of names.
That's what I was trying to say.
But the thing is, you said you could put in any name. Well, they gave you a list of names, and they gave you nicknames too. So, I mean, there was actually nicknames like Stinky or Goofy or stuff like that. And he'd actually say, "Okay, Stinky, it's your spin, Stinky." But I think the game had probably, I'm going to say somewhere in the 150 and to 200 preloaded names. You couldn't put in your own name if it wasn't one of those preloaded names, but they covered all the popular normal names. I'm sure Chico was in there at some point as a nickname.
Probably. I don't know.
Well, I don't think Dino was. I might be wrong about that. But yeah, once you chose your name through an alphabetical list, Wink would actually say the name you chose. So that was a very, it gave it a personalized touch. But also, if you were a kid and the regular Joker's Wild was a little too old for you, there was the Joker's Wild Jr. And that was hosted by Mark Summers. Same exact rules, except there was no devil. In this version, there was a dragon. And it wasn't like the nice cutesy dragon from Tic-Tac-Toe. It was a mean, fire-breathing dragon, I'm sure. Might have given some kids some nightmares back in the day.
Ah.
Well, if only there was, like, if only the dragon rapped.
No, we're not going to do that.
No, 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 no.
No, 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 no. 1,000 times no.
So, Greg, where I really thought you were going with this, and I realized that this wasn't in the infomercial, is I thought you were going to talk about a game involving toasters that toast toast. And what we're talking about is Hotel Mario, the Mario entry for the CDI, which is probably the worst version of Mario ever.
Ever?
Ever. I've played ever. Enough Mario games in my life where I can say with confidence the word ever.
Yeah.
And actually, we're going to throw in right now the opening of the Hotel Mario game with Mario reading a letter.
Nice of the princess to invite us over for a picnic, eh, Luigi? I hope she made lots of spaghetti.
Luigi, look! It's from Bowser. Dear pesky plumbers, the Koopalings and I have taken over the Mushroom Kingdom. The princess is now a permanent guest at one of my 7 Koopa hotels. I dare you to find her if you can. We gotta find the princess. And you gotta help us. If you need instructions on how to get through the hotels, check out the enclosed instruction book.
You know, guys, I always sarcastically say that something that was terrible is the greatest thing ever, but I can't do it in this case. Hotel Mario is truly terrible. It is not good. It's the worst.
I don't think you're going to have any disagreement from any of us here. And again, that's a game that I have, sadly. It is absolutely just abysmal. It's horrible.
While you guys were talking about Hotel Mario and how insanely bad it is, and it is insanely bad, by the way, I was busy looking at the infomercial and thinking to myself, you know, as monotonous as Pantsuit Lady is, I have to wonder how much more excited this Phil guy can possibly get, because it seems like everything he's approaching on this super wall of life here is... I've never seen a person so animated.
It's the meaning of life. Of course you're going to be animated.
I mean, come on. What other system lets you watch like thrilling movies in MPEG 1 quality?
Yeah, on what other video game system or what other console will you find a video game devoted to future entry, Thunder in Paradise? So,
what other game, what other multimedia entertainment console will let you play with Hulk Hogan?
I don't know. Is there something on the 3DO?
Oh, brother.
Hey, yes, brother, let me tell you about this. Hey, brother, let me tell you about the Panasonic 3DO. You know something, Mean Gene.
Panasonic 3DO. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, boy.
I had one of those, too, and I got it, like, really cheap.
Oh, my goodness, that's a large controller. I'm looking at the pantsuit lady is holding the roller controller.
Well, that you had, I think you had to buy separately. At least it didn't come with my version, and that was for the kids. That's not something that you could play Thunder in Paradise on.
Yeah.
Though I think it happened if you tried.
Hold up. What if you could play Thunder in Paradise with the kids' controller?
Well, that's why I said I think you could try. It might be really fun that way.
what I was gonna say was. You probably don't know this because you weren't in the Northeast like me. But you know a chain called Nobody Beats the Wiz?
Yeah, right? I do.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they didn't have CDI back in the day, but they did have a display for the 3DO. And do you know what one of the games they displayed on the 3DO was?
I can only imagine.
Wing Commander 3 with Mark Hamill and Malcolm McDowell.
Well, Mark Hamill needed a paycheck in
1994. Yeah, well, those Batman paychecks.
No, he was still cashing paychecks from the Joker, so.
Yeah, the Star Wars sequels wouldn't be, like, for another 20 or so years.
Right. I'm thinking about some of the games that that the CDI had, and really, there were some that, I mean, they were very unique, but the thing is, they're very, very rudimentary. One game, and this isn't mentioned in the infomercial, it's called Efficer, E-F-F-A-C-E-R, and essentially what it is, it's Hangman in outer space, and I'm not even joking about that. You're playing Hangman and in like a futuristic space area, and I spent money on this game, folks. I spent money on frigging Hangman for the CDI. No regrets.
Okay. Jeez. Hey, not judging you. I'm not judging you.
A fool and his money are soon parted. And I was a fool back in the day. But yeah, in addition, another thing that just going through the infomercial briefly, not that much time is actually devoted to the meaning of life. Going through the infomercial, it's on YouTube. At least half the time I think is spent getting testimonials from families and people that own a CDI. The last 2 minutes of the infomercial is just testimonials for the CDI.
But those were all repeated throughout the half hour too. So
yeah, I mean they did it like the same testimonials like three different times. It's almost like any infomercial you see nowadays for Emeril's cooker or whatnot. You know, and they show the same thing. 3 minute clip. While Emeril's cooking the roast in his rotisserie or whatever. Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry. It gets repetitive in that way.
That makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the thing is, this infomercial was on all the time. I mean, I've seen it late at night. I saw it on Saturday afternoons. I saw it in the morning. So at some point in like 1994, 1995, you were sure to run into this at some time. But alas, it's just a footnote in history, and the meaning of life. Alas, it's a footnote in history, and the meaning of life itself. Who knew the meaning of life would just be a thing on TV?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
To October 28th, 2003, for a total of 10 episodes.
10 glorious episodes.
10 sainted, vaunted episodes. So, now that we're all here, hi, I'm Chico, that's Greg, that's Mike. And we're about to talk about the true story of another real fake. And I don't mean the actual guy, I mean the actual show. The show itself is a group of contestants living in the lap of luxury, hoping for $100,000 in the title of Lap of Luxury Champion. There's just one thing, though.
Huh?
Yeah. Matt Kennedy Gould is one of the contestants, and so far as we know, he's the only contestant. It's time for a backstory. So the Joe Schmo Show was created by the team of Paul Wernick and Rhett Reese, who would later go on to be the authors of both Deadpool movies, which were awesome, by the way. And they, what they had in mind was one person, sort of like the Truman Show, one person who didn't know that the reality show he was on was incredibly staged with actors, scripts, writers, producers, and directors.
And it was all built around Matt Gould.
Yep.
He was the only one that wasn't in on the joke, if you will. And it was glorious. But also it showed a real sense of humanity. I mean, he did so many things in the show which showed how great of a guy he was.
Yeah, and the thing of it is, he was originally, you know, he was originally supposed to be the mark because, well, that's what you need when you're pranking somebody is a mark. But the thing of it is, everybody grew to love him. The audience, the producers, the cast. You almost forget that they're actors playing roles.
Yeah, it was so bizarre that ultimately, in the end, in episode 9, before the aftermath, where they showed everything about basically how it all broke down and how they sort of purposely tried to let Matt win, you know, just because you don't want to boot him off because he's the central character in this, even though he doesn't know it. He uttered a phrase, and if you missed it, it's in our new open, but we'll put it in here.
What Matt?
What is going on? What is going on?
What is going on?
Whenever you think of the Joe Schmo Show, that is the one moment you think of at the top of your head.
Oh, that is the only moment. But how we got there, oh, really?
Oh, man.
Oh, this is amazing.
Yeah. So before we get there, let's introduce our esteemed cast of characters by way of a reenactment of the opening narration from Family Guy voice actor Ralph Garman. What would you do if your entire world turned out to be fake? If an army of writers, producers, and actors spent over a year creating TV's most elaborate experiment around you? They plotted your every move, recorded it 24 hours a day, and put it on national television. Well, that's exactly what happened to this guy. Meet Matt Kennedy Gould, one real guy competing for $100,000 on a reality show that he doesn't know is fake. Starring 9 actors. By the way, this is a Chico note. Some of these names will sound familiar.
Oh, yes. I was just going to say that a number of these people went on to much bigger and better things.
Yeah.
Specifically one, but there's legitimately 4 people on here who really, at some point, went on to bigger and better things.
Yes.
Yeah. Melissa Yvonne Lewis as Ashley, the rich bitch. David Hornsby as Hutch, the asshole. Angela Dodson as Molly, the virgin. Franklin Jones as Earl, the veteran. Nikki Davis as Gina, the schemer. Lance Kroll as Kip, the gay guy. Brian Keith Etheridge as Brian, the buddy. Kristen Wiig as Dr. Pat, the quack. And Ralph Garman as the smarty host. All performing for the one guy who thinks it's all real.
And Chico mentioned a couple of names that, well, at least one name should sound familiar to everybody who's listening. Kristen Wiig.
Yeah.
And I know back in the day, Greg, he, like, just loved what she did. Oh, absolutely hilarious. God. Talking about Dr. Pat.
Oh, boy.
And this is about the time that she, I think, hit it sort of big with SNL, so you're talking probably about 12 years ago at this point.
It's 2003, so it would be 17 years.
Well, Kristen Wiig wasn't on SNL until like 05, 06.
Yeah, but like I said, I think when she hit it big, that was like the keywords. I know she might have started SNL before, but I really think she gained her, I don't want to say notoriety, her popularity as we got later into about, again, 2007, 2008, when she started doing the Target lady, and she was doing the Lawrence Welk singer with the baby arms. I'm sorry, that's classic. I die whenever I see that.
And folks, this won't be the last time we talk about Kristen Wiig on this podcast, because we'll be talking about her in Future Entry with Will Ferrell, A Deadly Adoption.
Yeah, we will.
So we have, again, all of these actors playing all of these reality show tropes, and Matt, who has absolutely no idea what any of this is leading up to.
But also, just before we go on, just quickly, the other names that you might recognize. Lance Kroll, who played the gay guy, like to the hilt. He was...
Oh.
I don't know if you could say, there's a perfect gay guy. He played like the perfect gay guy. He did such a great job. He had his own self-titled TV show on Comedy Central a number of years back. Oh, should we add that to the list?
I'm adding it to the list.
The Lance Kroll has been added to the list. Yay!
Show prep in the middle of recording.
Yeah, never an issue around here. And then David Hornsby, the asshole, Greg, you can tell people where he's from because you know more about the subject than I do.
Yeah, David Hornsby would be best known today among television viewers as Rickety Cricket on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And fun fact, guys, do you know who David Hornsby is married to?
No, who's David Hornsby married to?
Emily Deschanel.
Oh, okay.
Yes, he is married to Zoe.
Damn it!
Yes, he is the brother-in-law to Zoe Deschanel.
So he married Emily Deschanel. There's no bones
about
called, it.
That's called marrying up, by the way.
Okay, you missed the joke. I said Emily Deschanel. Oh, that's interesting. There's no bones about it.
Bravo.
But also, the other person is the host himself, Ralph Garman. You may not remember this. And most of you probably don't unless you saw it on my YouTube page back in the day. But he was a contestant in 1992 on a very small cable game show called Future Installment. I just love putting that in there. Let's go back.
Oh, yeah. But enough about Scott Sternberg's soul turned his host.
But then also, after this, Ralph Garman, he's been doing a ton of voices on Family Guy. So he's had very consistent work since just about the time this originally aired.
Yeah, and he's also done some work on Kevin Smith's various podcasts. Like, I think Hollywood Babylon's the one show that they do together.
Well, let's get into the show itself. What's the meat of the potato here? As we said, the entire premise of the show was basically this whole show was centered around Matt Kennedy Gould, and he was going to be the winner ultimately, unless he either quit or he did something stupid. But he was just such a great game player. I mean, he was such a genuine person. I mean, if I was a single girl, oh, God, I would have fallen in love with him because he was just the sweetest, most empathetic and sympathetic person. Oh, he was just such a great human being.
Well, America ultimately fell in love with him because by the time the show ended, it ranked among one of the top – the finale ranked among one of the top cable entries for all of 2003. Over 3 million viewers.
And actually, the finale got the best ratings for Spike TV / the National Network / TNN in its history outside of wrestling.
Safe to say it probably drew more than TNA wrestling, am I right? Oh!
This podcast draws more viewers and listeners than TNA wrestling. What are you trying to say? But yeah, so the whole hoax here was a show called Lap of Luxury. And Chico mentioned earlier the $100,000 top prize being given to the eventual winner, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And it was basically a stereotype of like all of the other reality shows at the time.
It was basically Survivor in a house.
It was Wacky Survivor in a very fancy house, yes.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you have some games for prizes, and you're trying to avoid the dreaded moment in the show when your commemorative plate is smashed in the fireplace. Or, as Ralph put it, one of you is about to say goodbye to high society and return to your sad existence of working for the man.
And of course, after the player was voted off, he'd state a rhyming couplet that would go, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, blank name, you're dead to us. And then he would throw the plate into the fireplace, breaking it.
And the look of disgust on some of the people still in the game when that was done. Oh my gosh! Again, they played this to the hilt. The only one who wasn't in on this was Joe Schmo himself. So yeah, so you may have had a little bit of overacting or something like that from the rest of the cast, But it was, I mean, it's a parody in and of itself. It's great.
It's incredibly meta.
Oh, super meta. That it was meta before meta was a thing.
Meta was a thing on TV. But that's another episode. Please continue.
So, we began the show on September 2nd, 2003 on Spike, and it was a two-hour premiere, folks. This was heavily hyped. I remember all the promos on Spike TV plugging this, and I was like, oh my god, there's going to be a show about a guy who's on a reality show, and he has no idea that the entire reality show around him is fake. Oh my god. And the big hype is, how is this show going to end?
Well, also in the promos, the big thing, and we mentioned it earlier, what is going on? I mean, that was like the big draw was in the ads was Matt Gould saying, what's going on? So you had to see what was going on.
But we will get to what was going on momentarily, because Greg, you've got the episode guides up.
Yeah, so let me read each episode one at a time for you. Okay, the first episode in episode one. Viewers meet Matt Kennedy Gould, the unknowing Mark, on a phony reality program called Lap of Luxury. He meets the various other players on the show, who, unbeknownst to him, are all secretly actors and actresses working from a script. Things get started right away with the first pampering competition, a game in which everyone dresses up in each other's undergarments. The game is rigged so that Matt will lose, and he's forced to wear Kip's for the rest of the day.
Kip would probably enjoy it if Kip were real.
Episode 2, the second part of the two-hour premiere. The Hutch perfectly plays his role as the asshole, irritating everyone, but winning quote-unquote immunity in a game called Hands on a High-Priced Hooker. Matt forms an alliance with Gina, the schemer, but doesn't know what to do when he's caught in a setup in which the other players find her secret notebook where she's been writing mean things about them. The first ridiculous riches-to-rags eviction ceremony, Gina is booted from the game, and Matt ends up all too happy with it after he deduces that she cast her vote for him.
Well, it would make sense if it was A, if it was a unanimous decision that Gina was to be evicted, and B, if it was all real.
Yes.
Well, the thing that scares me is, you know, even Matt getting some votes. Now, I think if he got no votes, that'd be suspicious. You know, one here or there is not suspicious. But what if you had like three or four people voting for him in that episode? Then your whole premise is blown up unless you say, oh, well, you got immunity because you found the secret notebook of Gina in her bedroom or whatnot.
But remember, these are actors working on a script, so Matt is going to stay on for as long as possible. Otherwise, you got no show. Continue, yep. Greg.
Yep. Episode 3. Kip takes the opportunity to share some of the photos he's collected in his creature comfort item, his photo album. Molly is relieved when she learns that her suspicions that Matt has caught on to the fakeness of the show are misplaced. A pampering competition features the supposed dirty laundry of the various cast members and makes them dress up in funny outfits. The guys lose this competition, allowing Hutch to pull a prank in which he replaces the photos in Kip's album with ones of his own ass.
I'm sorry. Okay, continue.
At dinner, Ralph gives all the players autographed headshots of themselves. Later, everyone says nice things to each other in the hot tub.
That's great. I think the only way this would have been better is if somehow Kip got a photo of his own ass that was autographed.
Well, we'll stick around. You just might.
And you know, those would be valuable on eBay nowadays. Who wouldn't want a Kristen Wiig's Dr. Pat photo signed Dr. Pat? Think of the possibilities. I mean, that I think that would be cool. Yeah, I know Greg would have that hanging in his bedroom.
Yeah, it'd be hanging right next to the pictures of Super Train and Second Chance and Mr. Smith on my wall.
Jeez.
Episode 4. naturally reveals to Beth that she has a secret crush on Ralph, the host, and also that she thinks that Molly may not be as innocent as she seems. Matt is not impressed and begins scheming to try and vote her off the show. The immunity challenge showcases the various cast members displaying special talents, such as Kip doing bad magic and Matt beatboxing. Hutch, quote-unquote, wins the competition, judged by Ralph and Survivor 2's Jerry Maffney, by performing a moving rendition of America the Beautiful. Emotions run high at the Richard Starrag's eviction ceremony. Matt's plan does not go as he had hoped, and it is Earl who is evicted from the show. Matt takes his ejection hard, along with the rest of the cast, and everyone involved with the project is left wondering if it's right to continue it.
Yep.
Boy, we had a Jerry Maffney sighting. I mean, that wasn't, you know, rare in 2003. Everybody milking their Survivor time.
You mean yeah. Jerry Maffney was on a show besides Survivor? I'm shocked. This is my shock face.
No, I'm just saying, and not necessarily just Jerry Maffney, but like everybody from season one and season two of Survivor. You had Richard Hatch, you had Rudy Bosch, who just unfortunately passed away within the last year or so, and you had, that Colleen girl, I can't think of her name.
Colleen Haskell. Haskell.
Yes, Colleen Haskell was, she did movies. She was with, I think, David
Schneider in The Animal.
Yeah.
It was box office gold.
Well, fool's gold. And also you had Elizabeth Hasselbeck before she became married to a football backup quarterback.
Yep. So everybody is wondering if they should even continue with this farce. And ultimately it's resolved in the next episode, which Greg is about to go over.
Episode 5. The game continues despite the tensions caused by the previous week's eviction of Earl. Matt is shocked to learn of an apparent one-night stand between Dr. Pat and Hutch. The immunity competition causes real trauma for Dr. Pat. She's knocked down and hurt by Matt in a sumo uniform and has to be taken to the hospital. Matt later gives her his prize for winning the sumo competition before the start of the immunity game, Master Debater, which Matt wins. The Richest to Rags ceremony features a special offer, a $25,000 reward if she will leave the game voluntarily. And this is probably maybe one of my favorite episodes from this first season of the show. Because if I'm not mistaken, Kristen Wiig actually got like a concussion from this competition.
Well, yeah, she went to the hospital. Yeah. Oh, it was bad.
Oh, yeah. This was, yeah, she was definitely in the protocol, and they had to call in a four-wheel ambulance. Of course, they had to find some way to get Matt away as they're carting Kristen Wiig off, obviously. But the next day, Dr. Pat returned, and Matt, because he's Matt freaking Kennedy Gould, ladies and gentlemen, decided to give her his prize. And again, that really tugged at heartstrings.
Absolutely. That shows how genuine and nice he was. But just Dr. Patton Hutch, I'm sorry, that sort of proves that the asshole always gets the top prize. Always gets the good females or spouses or partners. I'm going to be an asshole. That'll get me a girlfriend.
Don't walk down that road, Mike.
I'm kidding. Don't walk down that road, Mike Klaus. I'm kidding. I'm a genuine person. I would never do that.
But the best part is, if I'm not mistaken, Ralph offers Dr. Pat the $25,000, and she's like, "Oh yeah, so I'll just take the money."
She got on SNL. Can you blame her?
Yeah, even so, yeah, you imagine, yeah, she's probably going to take it. She's in no state to continue after Matt clocked her, albeit accidentally.
Episode 6. The drama between Molly and Ashley continues when Ralph pulls aside Molly for a private conference. The pampering competition forces Ralph to dress up in a bee costume. something with which he is not happy at all about. Matt and Molly are paired up in the competition and lose, and they face the penalty, being handcuffed to each other for the rest of the day. Molly's fake boyfriend comes by to play the guitar for and sing a song, but goes ballistic when he sees her chained to Matt and wearing a bikini. Ralph makes an executive decision to remove the handcuffs, and then the two of them go off for a little private time, while Matt laments that the show is starting to F and drive him crazy. Ashley wins an immunity challenge that's Matt's worst nightmare. Models covered with chocolate, which he finds gross. Her immunity turns out not to matter because it riches to rags. The Hutch is tossed out of the game for making threats towards Kip, but not before grabbing his collector plate out of Ralph's hands and thrusting it into the fireplace.
Yeah, that was one of the landmark clips of the series, which was Hutch taking his own plate and basically doing what comes natural after you've been unceremoniously kicked off the show, which is like, screw this show, screw you guys, screw this plate, screw this fireplace, screw everything. I might screw you later, Molly.
But again, he's playing the asshole to the hilt. Perfect. Yes. Perfect.
That is a chef's kiss in assholery.
And then in episode 7, the Hutch returns to the show, along with a legal-sounding document aimed at Matt, who had spent some time at law school. With his return, Ralph announces that it's double trouble day. Two people will win immunity, but two will be sent packing. Matt balks at a gross food challenge that would supposedly require him to eat dog feces, leading to a meeting with a Spike TV executive. The over-the-top executive convinces Matt to get Molly and Ashley to kiss so that they can win the prize for the competition, a 42-inch television.
42 inches was a lot in 2003.
And it's probably a CRT TV, not like a plasma.
No, it was a plasma. It was a plasma.
Oh, that was expensive back in the day. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Later, both Matt and Hutch win immunity in the rigged Lord of the Manor immunity showdown, which didn't go quite as planned. At the Richest to Rags ceremony, Molly and Kip are ejected, and Ashley gets another opportunity to whine about Molly's supposed flirting when Ralph lets her keep her ceremonial collector's plate, and then the two of them kiss.
Because it's Spike TV.
This is what men wanted in 2003, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, some men are still waiting for it in 2020.
Hey, guys, they didn't call Spike TV the first network for men for nothing.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Right.
Episode 8. At the top of the episode, Ralph reveals a surprise sudden death eviction. Matt goes through the motions of plotting to vote out his friend Brian. But in the sudden death ceremony with Ralph wearing their immunity robe, Matt, Brian, and Hutch all vote out Ashley. After an appropriately snotty speech, she leaves, and then the entire cast returns, as the final ceremony will be coming shortly to determine the winner of the $100,000. A final dinner causes a minor panic in Brian and Hutch when Matt reveals that he thought that maybe the fake network executive from the previous episode could be an actor. At the final ceremony, Brian, Hutch, and Matt answer questions posed to them by the evicted cast, and then a vote is held to determine the winner for the $100,000. 5 out of 6 votes are revealed, but the 6th is left a mystery to be shown in the season finale.
Ooh, it's a cliffhanger!
So, guys, at the end of episode 8, it was all down to Dr. Pat. She had the final vote to see who would win the competition. And so, in the final episode, on October 28th, 2003, we take a look back at some of the highlights of the show, and afterwards we pick up where we left off, waiting for the reveal of the final vote to determine the winner of the $100,000. So it's in the hands of Dr. Pat, and her choice is Hutch!
Well, of course, because Hutch didn't knock her out and send her to the hospital.
Yeah, and yeah. Hutch, I believe Hutch and Dr. Pat, you know what? We'll continue, Greg.
Well, we mentioned earlier that they were definitely a thing on TV in 2003, if you know what I mean.
They were an after-hours thing on TV.
Oh, jeez.
Hutch is declared the winner, and there's a big celebration with balloons and everything until the fake Spike TV executive comes in, and Ralph makes an announcement that someone is not who they claim to be. Matt then learns that the Hutch is actually an actor. In fact, everyone is. The show is based around him, and he is the winner of the $100,000, as well as all of the other prizes from the show. Next, Matt has a meet and greet session with all the cast and crew and learns how this great reality experiment was put together.
It was really one of the great moments in reality TV. Again, just the utter shock, the utter surprise. And Matt was like overcome with emotions over this whole thing. You're getting the $100,000. You're getting the trip. You're getting the TV. You're getting all this. And this whole series was made for you. And we spent a year working on it. It really was beautiful TV. Beautiful.
Yeah, and one of the prizes he got, which was actually a genius of corporate synergy, a trip to the real lap of luxury, the Spike TV launch party at the Playboy Mansion.
Oh, there's the other part. That's why it's the lap of luxury, at the Playboy Mansion.
This was back when the Playboy Mansion was actually a thing in Los Angeles.
And if I'm not mistaken, wasn't the Spike TV launch party not officially the Spike TV launch party? Because when Spike Lee's like, no, hold on, no. If people watch Spike TV, they're going to think I'm involved. Like, what?
Right, remember, yeah, he actually filed a lawsuit. Because, yeah, he didn't want people confusing Spike TV with him, or there may have been some possible defamation or something. But I remember that Spike Lee did file a lawsuit. Yes.
Yep. And ultimately, there was an injunction that prevented Viacom, which owns the network at the time, from using the Spike name until the matter was resolved. Well, obviously, the matter was resolved, and they went from TNN. They built themselves in commercials as, like, today, tonight on the First Network for Men, but they were using the TNN logo. But ultimately, they did go on to use the Spike name, and the rest, as they say, is history.
And then it became Paramount Network, and here we are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that was the Joe Schmo Show.
We still have an aftermath to talk about.
I forgot about that. Talk about the aftermath.
So we get into Joe Schmo the aftermath. In Joe Schmo the aftermath, we learn such tidbits as the most tense moment for the cast and crew, how much Matt really suspected about what was happening on a scale of 1 to 10, and which of the girls Matt really lusted after the most. Matt also learns many things that he never knew before about the show. Jackson surprises abound in a very candid interview session with Matt.
Yeah, this is sort of like seeing how the proverbial sausage was made. And again, it was very in-depth, very complex, and just fascinating. I mean, it was a great way to wrap up the show. It's better than like every other reality show where, okay, you found, your boyfriend, or you're the last survivor. Let's have this little after party. Yeah, woo! No. They actually showed like how we got there. That was like, again, absolutely.
It was brilliant. Smart. It was absolutely smart.
It was super smart, especially if they only did one season of this. But that's another episode.
Mm-hmm. But this wasn't the end for anybody, for everybody here on the Joe Schmo Show. It's like we said, the creators, Paul Wernick and Rhett Reese, they would end up being really big deals in Hollywood. They worked on Zombieland, nice, and they also worked on both Deadpool movies, also nice, and... You already know what Kristen Wiig is doing.
We're going to get more depth into seasons 2 and the eventual reboot in 2013 in later episodes. But Joe Schmo 2 was similar but not as good. Nobody could beat the reactions and how Matt was in season 1. But they tried, and it was a little different. We'll get into it later. I don't want to spoil too much. We did get at least one quality actor or actress from the season 2 cast. someone by the name of Natasha Leggero, who you would better know from Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Among other things.
And other things, but she's probably best known for that. And then also the return in 2013. Really, there's one name which sticks out, and it's because of the actor's last name. But also, has a job nowadays. Let's say that a job that there may be some familiarity with. Robert Belushi, who is the son of Jim Belushi, and currently hosts the Game Show Network show Get a Clue.
Yep. Yes.
Future entry? It's a good enough show in its own right. We'll see how that works out. Chico, I think now you can put closure on it.
I'm about to put closure on it. The Joe Schmo Show. One poor schmo thinks it's all real, and everybody else knows the truth, though. It was a thing on TV.
It was a thing on TV, and you can get it now on DVD on Amazon Prime for $10.97.
Well, actually, I was at a used video game and DVD store earlier this week, and I did see a copy of, I think it was even the uncensored version of Season 1. I should have asked how much it was and bought it, but I figured, you know what, I have good enough memories of the show. And gosh knows what would be on the uncensored discs. Probably a little bit more of that kissing and Matt being handcuffed to the one girl.
It takes off all the bloops and bleeps and leaves in all of the filth.
And probably there's some nudity with the chocolate being poured on that competition. But, yep. It's out there if you want to pay a little bit money for it. The DVD box set of the show, the aired version, the censored version, if you will, is available on eBay. But for years, oh, my, this has been selling for amazing amounts of money. I mean, I remember back in the day that it went easily for like $50 or $60. I mean, this is legitimately maybe a $20 or $30 box set, but it was selling for a lot more. So yep. Either there's rarity or people remember the show, and I think it might be a combination of both, but definitely column B, that people remember it and enjoyed it.
Yep.
So that's Joe Schmo Season 1 at the very least. And at some time in the future, we'll cover Joe Schmo Season 2 and the eventual reboot, because they stand out in their own rights.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, whoa, absolutely.
Especially Season 3.
Especially the reboot. Oh, yes. We will definitely be getting into that at some point.
So that was the Joe Schmo Show Season 1, and don't worry guys, we will get to Last Chance for Love, Monte Carlo the Falcon, and all the fun stuff from Joe Schmo Season 2 in the very near future. But we got some great shows to tell you about here on the Place to Be Nation's Pop Feed, and recently on the Brother Sister Rewatch podcast in episode 39, Kevin and Mary returned for another edition of the show, and they were taking on episodes 11 and 12 of The Office's fifth season, Moroccan Christmas and The Duel. They discussed a myriad of topics in this episode, including Dwight and Andy's showdown, Andrew playing both sides to the very end, Meredith's breakout performance, Phyllis's badass turn, and the lunacy of cake cutting fees. Cake cutting fees? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And on the 18th episode of Laugh-In Theater, host Andy Atherton is joined by the Godfather himself, Nate Melton, to do a live watch of the 2009 comedy Black Dynamite. The guys discuss blaxploitation films, underutilized actors like Michael J. White, the 1970s, bad acting, made-up words, movie cliches, kung fu, bitches, X-rated zodiac signs, Greek gods, The Last Dragon, and the great character names throughout the movie.
Also, be sure to check out the PTBN Wrestling Feed, which includes a dive into topics running the gamut from the days WWE through yesteryear. The feed includes the Place to Be podcast, Main Event, Wrestling Warzone, Extreme Three-Way Dance, Jenny and the Gems, Body Pressure Luck, PTV, NXT, and so much more. Subscribe today, and while you're at it, subscribe to Jennifer Smith's The Jenny Position feed as well, as it is the home of Geek and Sassy, Talk and Pop, Freak Out, Drive-In, Telling Stories, and more. And of course, as we always want to mention each week, we have our 2020 stretch project at Place to Be Nation, determining the greatest WCW match ever. You have all year to do research, promote matches, and build the list. Conversation rules can be found at www.facebook.com/GWCWmatches or on the Pro Wrestling Only message board. And be sure not to forget to check out placetobenation.com each and every day. We have new voices, fresh takes, bringing you articles on topics in the worlds of wrestling, sports, and pop culture, including Trent's SmackDown on Fox Report, This Week in the WWE by John Crow, Paulie's Perspective, Jason's DVD Deep Dive, and Ben's Unpopular Opinion. And don't forget about veteran columns like Glenn Butler's weekly Walk Around the Web. And if you're doing online shopping at Amazon.com, be sure to click on the Amazon banner at the right side of the Place to Be Nation homepage, or use www.placetobenation.com/Amazon. It takes you right to Amazon and helps out PTBN at no cost to you. So, let's get back to the show as we discuss our third and final topic, a show that you might have heard about back in the early to mid-aughts. It flipped around a bunch of various different channels over the years, but I can say that it's certainly memorable, some maybe for not so good reasons, but here we go as me, Chico, and Mike talk about the show Banzai.
Episode 26, Submission 122, Banzai!
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 Stay-at-home fun. From a land where anything is truly possible comes new gambling opportunity. Place your bets now. It's time to play Banzai!
To say the least, this was a goofy show. We didn't put in the airing history for it because it is a very complex history, at least on this side of the Atlantic. This is actually a British show to start off with. It did air for 3 seasons in Britain, and there were 24 episodes, including one special episode. It aired originally on the E4 network in England from January 18th of 2001 to May 15th of 2003. But the U.S., it has a little bit much different, much more complex lifespan because it originally aired on USA as interstitial clips during movies on Friday nights, I believe. Right. I think it essentially replaced what was Up All Night, or I'm sorry.
Yeah, it did.
All Night.
Future installment, Up All Night.
With
Ron USA Scher, who... Up All Night!
Oh, thank you, Gilbert. with, as we mentioned on the $1.98 Beauty Show episode, Rhonda Scher, former winner of the $1.98 Beauty Show.
Yes.
So in the United States, yeah, it aired briefly at night, in late night, on the USA Network during their movies, just in little tidbits.
Well, it would be Friday, because it was called Banzai Movie Fridays, so that would be the Gilbert Godfrey Up All Night.
Up All Night! No.
Thank you.
Can't do it. Fox picked up the series in 2003 and edited some of the content. And this is by saying that some people were from parts of the United States instead of from the United Kingdom, to give it, you know, a sense of authenticity over here, that it wasn't just imported. And it only lasted 6 episodes. Why did it last 6 episodes? And this is where Chico says, because it was racist.
That's racist, possibly.
Possibly.
Yeah. Oh. That's racist, definitely.
They played the stereotypes here.
Everything from, let's see, the dialogue, which was, and I have an example here. Place bets now.
Oh, it wasn't place bets now.
Price your bets. No bet, no get.
Yes, price your bets.
Betting ends.
With the gong. With the gong. Gong.
And this is where you kind of wish that this was a video podcast instead of an audio, because they had this sort of Chinese-Japanese-looking script, and the bottom said, place bets now, as subtitles.
Yes, and it looked like your stereotypical Chinese type of font. Yeah.
It was, and
they also had Japanese characters on the screen doing animations, while the music was playing. So it aired for 6 episodes here before it got pulled because of obvious racism. And it then ended up, yes, it ended up someplace else. Then in early 2004, it showed up on Comedy Central. But wait, there's more.
There's more?
But yeah, there's more. So reruns of Banzai then showed up on G4 in March of 2006. And remember, at this time, G4 really wasn't showing a whole heck of a lot of video game stuff. They had stopped showing Starcade by then. They were showing Cheaters, I believe. And they were showing Impossible Banzuki. And they were showing the original Ninja Warrior. They were showing Sasuke, I do believe, at that time.
Yes.
Oh.
But also they were showing original shows like Future Installment, Code Monkeys. One of the best cartoons ever. I'm sorry. I love Code Monkeys.
Well, yeah, you introduced me to Code Monkeys like when we started this show.
Yeah, and it is so clever. So clever. We're going to definitely cover that in the future. So if you're playing along at home, the timeline is the original version airing on E4 in Britain, then USA in clips, then Fox, then Comedy Central, then G4.
I'm confused.
Well, that's why I broke it down nice and slowly for everybody, because this show aired for a little while in many places instead of for a long while in one place. So the whole entire idea of the show was you fictionally placed bets on different events happening.
The two main ones that aired in the States were Shake Hands Man, where you would have Mr. Shake Hands Man try and maintain a handshake with people for as long as possible. Now, there were actually here's an interesting factoid. There are actually two Shake Hands Man.
Shake Hands Men.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the idea of the Shake Hands Man, he would come up to a celebrity, shake hands with the celebrity, and the idea was more or less, will he shake hands with this person for at least a minute? And some people would wiggle their way out of it. So one person I saw took her available hand and shoved his hand away from hers really fast. And some people would just be taking it like a man, just shake, shake, shake. And, a minute, 45 seconds later, 2 minutes later, the game's over. Oh, if you picked over 1 minute, you win.
Yep.
And that was on every show. Every show had Shake Hands Man. But then there were other contests, and going to Truth by Consensus Wikipedia, some of these I remember. You had Grannies Playing Chicken with Motorized Wheelchairs, which I remember that. Amputee Football, Egg Eating, Blindfolded Gas Pumping, and the length of time it would take an object to hit the ground after being dropped from a roof.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, there's one game I remember. They had three Michael Jackson imitators moonwalking on ice.
Yes, I remember that one.
Yes, they did.
They had three specific Michael Jacksons. They had the military Michael Jackson, they had Thriller era Michael Jackson, and they had Bad Skin era Michael Jackson.
And so they would moonwalk on the ice, and whoever got to the other end of the rink first while moonwalking on the ice was the winner.
Yes. The show sometimes had very inappropriate stunts or stuff at least you couldn't show in America. You had there was a game in which you, someone had to guess who had the longest penis in a lineup of people or who had the biggest breast implants. That one I do think actually made it over on this side. I remember that somewhat. Or how long – oh, this is horrible. I can't say this. How long it takes a Madagascar hissing cockroach to microwave.
Ew.
Okay, so – well, you were the, number one. But number two, now you got PETA mad at you. That's just so inhumane and horrible to do to a living creature.
Yeah.
But there was also, and I know Greg and Chico probably really enjoyed reading about this, there was a Doctor Who segment.
Yes. Of course, this wouldn't air in the U.S. because the revival.
The reference would be lost.
And the revival hadn't happened yet in the U.S. But there was a segment on the U.K. version where there was someone at the door. It's the Doctor. Doctor Who. That's exactly. So there were about four choices. Who was at the door? Was it Sylvester McCoy, Peter Davison, Tom Baker, or Colin Baker? Spoilers, it was Colin Baker.
And there was another Doctor Who-related bet here. Peter Davison was asked, which other doctor would he like to have sex with? Tom Baker, John Pertwee, or Sylvester McCoy? Now, remember that John Pertwee was long since dead, sadly.
Yeah.
And it gets even more cringy.
How could it get more cringy than that? Ew.
Yeah.
Yeah. So understandably, that didn't make it. But I'll tell you what did make it. Some guy in a recumbent bicycling contest with Lou Ferrigno, because at least then the reference would be gotten. And another thing that was gotten was a segment, and this was on all six of the Fox episodes, Lady One Question.
Yes, Lady One Question.
Yes. And what yes. What Lady One Question is a reporter, or a reporter, in air quotes, who would ask celebrities one question and then continue to stare at them while holding her microphone. And the first one they did, now remember, this was in 2003 or 2004 when American Idol was a thing on TV. And the first episode they did was Simon Cowell.
Well, yeah, Simon Cowell would have been very big overseas back then. So it wasn't just American Idol, but it's still something that's very relatable.
She made reference to what was then being called American Pop Idol.
Right. Well, so that actually would have been like 2002-ish, because I don't remember that ever using it.
They did use it. Either they used it, or they updated, or they used an updated version of it. But we got it.
Well, in addition to all that, believe it or not, there is actually a board game. And guess what, guys? I have a copy of the board game in front of me. Yes,
how are you going to make a board game out of? It's like, forget how he got it. How do you make a board game out of bonsai?
Well, it's pretty easy because this was released, I'm guessing. Well, let me take a look. Let me see if there's a date of publishing here. So the copyright on the board game is dated 2006, which is, again, 2 or 3 years after the Fox version aired. At this point, it was airing in reruns on G4. And what it was, and this is popular for back in the day, if you remember how games were back then. It was a DVD board game.
Ah, that explains it.
Yes. So you had a DVD which had a number of the clips from the TV show. So if you had already seen these, you sort of had a leg up on the competition. And what you had is it was up to four players. You have a little triangular sort of cup, and I'm actually holding one in my hands. There were four different colors. There's blue, green, red, and orange. The orange has, and each of these has 25 characters in it. The orange has 25 Kung Fu Carls, the world's last starfish assassin. The red has 25 Tacos Ticklers, or Tacos Ticklers, which are essentially octopus tentacles or squid tentacles.
No,
they're not real. They're plastic, mind you. There's 25 Loises, L-O-I-S-E-S, the Louisiana Squirrel Roll, which looks like, I'm going to assume, some type of sushi. And then the green, there's 25 Chums, which are just little fish, little green fish. So what the idea was is, and I've got the rules right here, the stunt, the premise for the stunt appears on TV after you play the DVD. Depending on the challenge, anywhere from 2 to 5 different on-screen outcomes will appear. Players will bet their sushi on these outcomes. But wait, there's a catch. Hey, let's make it more stereotypically racist. How are people going to bet their currency, their fish? You have to use chopsticks and get it in another separate bowl. And yes, it came with 4 sets of chopsticks. 4 sets of plastic chopsticks. Players had 15 seconds to make their sushi wagers. Using only their chopsticks, they had to transfer their individual sushi to their sushi betting bowls. They couldn't touch the sushi or the sushi bowl with any other part of their body. So they couldn't use their fingers. Everything had to be done with your chopsticks. So if you didn't know how to use chopsticks, you couldn't bet that much, I would presume. And then the person who got the most sushi into their betting bowl got control of the bet and the best odds of winning the round. So the person who bet the most sushi, there were different betting cards, and I have actually all of them right in front of me. I'm going to take a look at the red ones first because I'm assuming it's yellow, not orange. The green and blue are probably the same. But so there were 5 cards, and they just said A, B, C, D, and E. And so each one corresponded to a different outcome on the screen, sort of like what we talked about earlier, you know, with Mr. Shake Hands. Will he shake this person's hands for under 30 seconds, 30 seconds to a minute to a minute 30, a minute 30 to 2 minutes, or 2 minutes or above? And so the person that won the bet got to make the first wager. Okay, so this actually, the rules of this actually turn out to be like poker, because each player can either match the top bettor's amount of sushi by anteing up, sort of like poker, or they can choose to fold and sit out the round. So essentially, this is like poker meets bonsai, but with an Asian twist, a racist Asian twist. And
this isn't racist stuff. I get it.
Yeah, this isn't like overly racist. If you fold, you have no chance of winning the pot. They tell us this in the instructions. The players who did not fold and chose to stay in the round now place the card representing their guess for the what they think is going to happen. And you win the pot by playing the stunt on the DVD. The outcome's revealed. The player with the card under their betting bowl, they'll reveal their guesses. If their card matches the actual outcome on the disc, they win all the sushi in the pot. If they guess wrong, then all the other players still in the round show their cards. The pot is divided among everyone who guessed correctly. If nobody guessed correctly, then each player removes the sushi they bet, puts it back in their bowl, and lather, rinse, repeat. We do it all over again. And there actually is no sense of closure here. It doesn't say whoever gets all 100 pieces of sushi wins, whoever gets 50 wins. It just says you keep on playing. You're in an infinite loop.
You keep on playing until somebody dies of ennui.
Yeah, until somebody gets bored to death or until somebody beats them because this is terribly racist. But yeah, the only reason I got it is because I remember Banzai, and it was like $5. And it was at one of the Go K calendar and bookstores and game stores that you see. But this wasn't a pop-up store. It was actually a tangible store that was in downtown Cleveland during the 2000s. Oh, plus also, to make it even more racist. Hey, why not? Why not maximize the racism? Everybody had a headband they had to wear when they played the game. It had red and white stripes on it, and it says, has the Banzai logo on it. It's just a cardboard headband, but again, it just like insinuates the stereotype. So that's the most racist board game ever. And if you want more of this, next month we're actually doing an episode on board games based on TV shows. So we got the Banzai board game out of the way. There's more to come, and trust me, there's a lot more bad board games out there, and some of us, specifically me, has spent money on them for you, our audience.
Mike, you actually bought board games
Yes, I did. I don't want to spoil what I bought, but if you follow our Twitter, I did post a picture of it when I bought it back about 2 months ago, a month and a half ago.
Oh.
So there's a preview as to one thing we're going to cover.
Hey, we if you've listened closer to our past catalog, you know the tease of what's coming.
Yeah, and there's some really bad games here, and that'll be a fun episode because we're actually going to play the games.
So there is a viable reason why it didn't go past 24 episodes in the UK, let alone the 6 of them that aired on Fox. Well, let's start with Fox here, because 2 years before Fox aired its episodes, you had the clips on USA, Asian American groups objected to them, and then when Fox picked up the show, Asian American groups objected to the show, and I actually have a quote from the founder of Media Action Network for Asian Americans, Guy Aoki. It's just all the backwards images of Asian American people. This is like an Asian minstrel show. Can you imagine the black version of Banzai? I can, and I don't like it. Anyway, sponsors were alerted to the show. Many dropped the sponsorship, and Fox canceled it after 6. But in the UK, that was not the worst of it. Let's go to 2002, April 2002. They attempted to record a sketch where they were trying to measure the speed of a funeral procession.
Wait for it, yes.
It was the funeral of the Queen Mother, Queen Elizabeth.
Oh, you can't do that. No, 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 no.
No, 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 no. To say the very least, that was just bad.
Well, yeah, when you offend the crown head of state for your nation, yeah, that's probably going to get you booted really fast, especially someplace that has a big legacy like the United Kingdom. So it wasn't really the racism that got it booted. It was recording the speed of the Queen Mum's funeral procession.
Seems like it.
Mm.
There are just some things you don't do, and that was one of them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. Well, I think we can put this one to rest. We can, like, bathe in our Clorox baths now and clean ourselves of this absolute racist mess.
Yes, it was yes, Banzai was you had a bunch of gambling on television, which is the norm now, but when you throw in a bunch of Asian stereotypes and try to offend for the sake of offense, what can you say except, yeah, everybody frowns on it now, but back in 2002, oh boy, it was a thing on TV.
Yep.
It was a thing on, like, every TV station. It got passed around quite a bit.
Yeah, like a babysitter that didn't want to deal with a baby's bottom.
That's an interesting comparison.
Have you ever seen a baby's bottom that you didn't want to deal with? I rest my case.
And that has been another installment of Chico Says Way Too Much.
Why would you say way too much on our website at itwasathingontv.com, where you can find out about the show, about each other, listen to past episodes, and follow us on social media.
And especially thank you for everybody who's following us now. I shared this with Chico and Greg before we started recording. The number of people who are listening to the show has literally more than doubled over the past 2 weeks, and we thank you so much. And I mentioned also to Chico and Greg, the number of people who just started following the podcast on Facebook in the last week has gone up by like six. And I mean, yeah. You know, that doesn't sound big, but when you have 25 likes on Facebook and you go from 19 to 25, that's pretty significant.
Yes. And also, remember to listen every Wednesday. A couple of our episodes from our back catalog are slowly going up on the Place to Be Nation pop feed right now. So I think the last three episodes that came up were Meow Manor, Lidsville, and Judge Wapner's Animal Court. So
Yeah. Episodes 6, 7, and 8 got posted earlier this week, at least as of the time of recording. So, well, until next time, and next time isn't going to be Monday because we're doing a third episode this week, a Super Bowl special, as it were.
Yes.
And it's going to be a good one. Oh, this is a topic that we have been waiting to talk about. And it's when you think about Super Bowls, you think about a certain topic. No, it's not that topic. No, it does not involve a certain singer's breasts.
No.
But that is in the future.
That is on the list, but that is not what we're going to talk about.
We'll wait for next year to cover that. But this year, for our Super Bowl special, I think it's a classic from Super Bowl's past. And I think we're all going to be excited about this.
Oh, indeed. And that'll be coming out sometime later on this week. Probably either Friday the 31st or February 1st, right before the big game. So until then, until that episode drops, thank you, Chico. Thank you, Greg. Thank you for listening. And we'll catch you later on this week with a bonus episode of It Was a Thing on TV. Bye-bye.
Wow!
Bonzai!
Oh, look, it's Lady One Question. Mike, how long do you think that It Was a Thing on TV will be a very successful podcast?
Oh, I would say at least 100, 200 years. I mean, we'll be here. There'll be heads of us in formaldehyde. We'll still be talking in, like, the year 2220. And that was the one question. Da-da-da-da-da-da.